Welcome to the Revitalizing Doctor podcast. We interview trailblazers in medicine that embody the Revitalize Women vision to empower women to innovate and influence medicine to value authenticity, respect, and work-life harmony. We recognize the challenges in medicine, and we're committed to providing coaching-informed strategies to help you go from surviving to thriving. I'm so excited to have Dr. Jillian Schmitz, past president of the American College of Emergency Physicians, back on the podcast. And we are coming to you hot with a news alert about some very exciting things happening in the world of emergency medicine. And we're going to be deep diving the topic of ED accreditation. And I want to leave some time at the end to also talk about Dr. Schmitz's role in this and why, on her very busy plate of things, and now she's a past president, she didn't have to go full headfirst into this, about why this is so important to her. But let's start with, what is emergency department accreditation?
Well, thank you, Andrea, for having me. And I'm really excited to talk about this and how this can potentially really revolutionize emergency care. Accreditation, when people think about what that means, we think of, are you a level one trauma center? Are you a level two trauma center? Accrediting residency programs. There's so many different bodies that look at setting standards. And really, that's what this is an attempt to look at, is how do we raise the bar? How do we improve patient care? How do we promote fair, productive working environments for emergency physicians, really through the implementation of ACEP policies and evidence-based policies and practices to really improve patient care and standards for emergency medicine? It's a hard thing to get your head around, but it's something that has potential to be really exciting in really transforming the delivery of emergency care.
In some ways, I'd almost think, like, of course, emergency departments are accredited. So if a new hospital opens and they want to call themselves an emergency department, what determines that right now?
So that's a great question. There are different accreditation systems, but they're really limited to certain segments of patients, right? So you can have a level one trauma center, but we know in many places they're not trauma centers, or maybe they only see a small fraction of trauma numbers. There are stroke centers, there are cardiac center recognitions, but each of those relate to a specific, very narrow subset of patients. And emergency medicine is different, right? We see anyone, anywhere, anytime, and most people don't have a diagnosis when they walk in the door. They have a constellation of signs and symptoms. So this is really the first major attempt to kind of quantify all of that and really recognize and accredit the facility and the delivery of all emergency care that is provided. So right now, there are certain criteria for hospitals on being open 24 hours, but there's not a lot of consistency. And how do you staff that emergency department? Who's taking care of patients? What resources do you have? Unless you are one of those very narrow niche specific accredited bodies for specific types of patients.
So that gets at the why behind this, because there's a lot of challenges right now in emergency medicine and the board has a lot on their plate. So can you speak to more of the thought process behind this move to accreditation? Why is there some optimism among the board? I mean, this is an intensive process that has been undertaken, and expand on the why behind it.
I think it's important to start with knowing sort of the history of how did we get there. So many people don't know that there have been multiple attempts to accredit or certify emergency departments in the past, and they have all failed for many different reasons. When ACEP attempted to look at this in the past, the criteria were overly complex. There was heterogeneity of opinions. There was sort of a lack of an organized vision of what that could look like. SAEM tried to do this in the 1990s, and they had a discussion where their accreditation was very aspirational. And the problem was nobody really was interested in trying to reach that high bar. And at the end, only one hospital applied for accreditation, and the system was ultimately shut down. So we have optimism because now we've had some time to really think about it. And we started with kind of smaller groups. So ACEP began accrediting geriatric departments back in 2018. We now have almost 400 emergency departments who have been successfully accredited. ACEP has also looked at accrediting pain and addiction management emergency departments and those that offer ultrasound, and have successfully done this now in smaller niches to really understand the mechanics of what is the value proposition, what is the return on investment, how do we market this, how do we really take those steps and execute this to do it well. And I think some of the lessons we've learned is that as tempting as it is to set all of the standards really high and really aspirational, that that's a challenge and it's a reason others have failed in the past. And we have to sort of meet people where they are and start somewhere and over time increase those standards and to really try intentionally to not get lost in the weeds. I think another reason that programs have failed in the past is they got very detailed, very complex at the beginning. And I think it was a little overwhelming for hospitals who are trying to wrap their head around why they should invest in this. And I think the key here is starting simple, making it relatively attainable and having different options. So it's not a all in or no of yes, no, am I accredited, but having a tiered approach to level one, level two, level three of having different areas so we can meet different emergency departments, whether they're rural, whether they're a large urban academic center, to try and meet where they are. And the overarching goal is to improve the quality of care being delivered across all emergency departments, but recognizing that some are going to have different strengths and longer periods of time to get to that aspirational standard.
So let's get into some of the nuts and bolts about how this would actually work. So I heard there's tiers. Could you outline some of the criteria that will be used, for example, for level one?
Absolutely. So the biggest thing that people got their head around, I think that the differentiating factor between a level one, a level two, and a level three really comes down to two things. One is, how do you staff the emergency department? How do you provide adequate supervision of different providers who are working in that emergency department? And two is social work and having the accessibility and the availability at different periods of the day or night in addressing patients' social needs, which is a huge part of our practice. Then there are a bunch of other things that are important, but we felt were really important across all levels. So they don't differentiate them, but sort of the standards for any emergency department to be accredited would have to have certain standards just at the beginning to be considered for accreditation. But if we focus on those two things that really stood out to us as what are some of the biggest differences is staffing. So part of it is that we recognize and appreciate that there are many different roles that different physicians, PAs, NPs, residents see in delivering care in an emergency department. And one of the big things that is variable across them is how do we supervise different providers, different learners in the emergency department? We know currently when we work with residents who can have 3 or up to 4 years of training, that as a emergency attending, I have to see all of their patients. It is a requirement for Medicare billing. And so many people felt strongly that we should have those same requirements in place if you had a PA or a nurse practitioner also seeing patients, and how we utilize our physician extenders and how we supervise them is really one of those key factors. So for a level one, every patient in the emergency department would be seen by a board certified emergency physician. And this means you can still utilize PAs and NPs, but it would require direct supervision, meaning that I would hear about their patients, I would physically see their patients and make sure I reviewed their vital signs, their labs. I would actually have, you know, a direct role in the care of their emergency department visit by seeing them physically in the ED. A level two would be where either a patient is seen by a board certified emergency physician, or you would have indirect supervision. And the definition of indirect supervision is that I hear about the patient in real time before the patient is admitted or discharged, but I may not necessarily see that patient. I may just be perusing the tracking board and looking at their labs as they come back, reviewing their vital signs. And I have a discussion real time with the PA or nurse practitioner with I'm working with to decide if I'm going to see that patient or not. A level three would depend on the level of acuity. So for our ESI levels, which are sort of our triage assignment, the sickest patients, level one, level two, would have to be seen by a board certified emergency physician. A ESI level three would require some conversation or indirect supervision where you're having a real-time discussion. But those kind of lower acuity fast track patients, level four, level five, could be seen by a PA or NP independently, because that is how many community hospitals are functioning currently. And then finally, we made a special carve out for rural emergency departments that would have sort of a fourth designation where they are required to have a physician on site 24/7, 365. However, because we acknowledge the gaps in rural care and that there's currently a lack of board-certified emergency physicians, we wouldn't require yet that that person be an emergency physician, but it has to be a physician. It can't just be a nurse practitioner or a PA seeing patients independently in those rural hospitals. And so that was kind of one of the major, I think, difficult decisions to come to, because many people are pushing for physician-led care, but want to see the evidence behind it. They want to see the impact. But we felt that that has always been ASAP standard, that we believe the aspirational standard is that every patient is seen by a residency-trained, board-certified emergency physician. And having two pairs of eyes on a patient with someone who's had less training is a good thing for patient quality care and to ensure that the optimal care delivery is really obtained. The second thing we talked about that differentiates a level one from a level two and level three is the availability and time of social work. So for a level one, ASAP is going to require that a social worker or case manager is available 7 days a week, at least 12 hours a day. A level two would be that a social worker is available at least 5 days per week, 8 hours a day. And that would not be a requirement, although it is encouraged for the other levels. So those are kind of the key differentiating things, and everything else is sort of just required regardless of what level you are, of what our definition of a quality emergency department would have.
Wow, that's really exciting. Another issue that I think comes up is the way the emergency department is staffed a lot of times is determined by a private group that contracts with the hospital. And then also some of the resources that are allocated are dependent on the hospital. My group doesn't employ social workers. We rely on the hospital to provide that resource. So how will accreditation address that tension between what groups have in their control versus what hospitals have in their control?
That's a great question. So ASAP has found that accreditation is really a tool to help get those resources. So for instance, with geriatric accreditation, many places did not have walkers in their emergency department, but we know that having a walker for elderly patients who are unstable is a critical asset to be able to discharge patients home safely. And because of that, many hospitals who used to not have them now routinely have them in their geriatric emergency departments because it is required. So accreditation helps give that value, that recognition of these are kind of key things that we've identified that every hospital needs in order to meet these standards. So our hope is that for people who don't have social work or caseworkers, that there will be an investment from the hospital to have those resources because it will help them qualify for a higher level tier. And this will be something that they want, that ability to market to other hospitals that we are a level one, we are a level two. But to do that, they have to invest in certain resources to meet those standards. And we're hoping that this will give some recognition of what we consider those valuable resources.
With geriatric certification, is there any coordination with patient advocacy groups? Because I'm wondering, like, does this actually get to the patients? Are they getting the information that, hey, this emergency department, kind of like when you look for a restaurant and you go on Google and you end up seeing, you know, what their stars are, what they offer, what their hours are. I think there would be value if the information was getting out to that level, that this is an accredited emergency department. This has the geriatric accreditation. Thinking about if I was traveling somewhere and didn't really know the hospital ecosystem, that information would be really powerful. So is there any coordination with patient advocacy groups or maybe policy stakeholders on how do we actually get this information out to the patients?
Yeah. So with geriatrics, there is coordination with a couple different groups who have been supporters of the accreditation program. So one is the John A. Hartford Foundation. The second is the West Health Institute. And that is really groups that help advocate for geriatric care and really have that symbol and that communication marketing piece to help advocate to patients, to the public, the value and the resources that this brings. There's obviously the physical sticker that the hospitals can put on their door when they are accredited. Many have opted to take out billboards on the highway to promote this in various ways to really help bring in patients. There's definitely a role and a niche. And I think that's part of the key to success is that you have to show value to the hospital. What do they get out of this? And a big part of it is being able to market to the public, to be able to differentiate themselves from other hospitals, competitors in the area, to demonstrate that they meet this higher level of really recognition.
Logistically, how will it work? Is it like a big application? And then what are the fees? Or do you have any idea? I know it hasn't been rolled out yet, but just to kind of ballpark what the financial investment will be for groups or hospitals.
Yeah, so we did a market search to kind of look and see what other accreditation programs are currently using and trying to get an idea of really the interest in this. And a group led through Dr. Christina Shenvey helped really do a market analysis for us and talking to chairs and medical directors and hospital executives to see really what the interest was. And our research shows that there's, again, numerous other bodies that have looked at specifically trauma or geriatric surgery or stroke centers. And those costs are variable and often tiered, but range anywhere from $11,500 to $42,000 per accreditation of those programs. Our geriatric program is sort of how we're modeling this after, where there's a higher price for level one. And that's because logistically, to verify your level one would really likely require an in-person visit where somebody is verifying that you're not just attesting that we do this, you actually have to see someone carry out that difference and then look at their staffing models, looking at their schedules, seeing how people are supervised and verifying that in person. So similar to the geriatric accreditation for a level one, it would be $15,000. And I believe that is over a 2 or 3 year process, but I will verify that. A level two would have, the application would have some demographic information, the ability to attest to certain things, but would likely be at a minimum, a Zoom interview. And we're going to ask for a list of their employees so that we can select at random some employees to verify some of that information. And certainly if there are discrepancies that come up in what a hospital reports they're doing and what the employees say is actually happening, that may trigger an in-person visit or sort of follow up on those things. A level three will likely be a process of attestation, but also uploading of policies. So for instance, when we talk about supervision or do you have a room for breastfeeding mothers in an emergency department, we're going to require actual pictures and documentation that you have these things in place, as well as obviously spot checking and randomly calling different employees to fact check and verify several of these standards.
So that's interesting what you just brought up there is we were focusing a lot on the requirements as far as direct patient safety regarding supervision, but you just mentioned that having appropriate lactation facilities will also be part of the consideration. Can you expand on some of the well-being and practice environment things that will be included in the accreditation?
Yeah, so some of the things that we've talked about of asking emergency physicians, what makes your practice safe? What makes you happy in your work environment? How do we ensure these best practices are carried out through all emergency departments? We got feedback from people across the country on what they would want in their ideal emergency department and what they think really should be a minimum standard for emergency departments. So some of the things that I will highlight is that we want to ensure that there is a sanitary, private, non-bathroom area that's proximal to the ED for employees who are breastfeeding. We want to require their translation services available either in person or telehealth, which would include a variety of different languages, also patients who are deaf, to be able to communicate with our patients and obtain accurate histories. We want to ensure that EDs have resources for victims of domestic and family violence. We want to have point of care ultrasound 24/7. Many of us take for granted that most emergency departments have that, but that is not the case. And particularly a lot of rural hospitals, there is no point of care ultrasound and how critical that tool is that we want to ensure that every emergency department has that resource for our docs. We want to ensure that there is a safety plan, particularly with increased firearm violence and violence in general in the emergency department, that we have a specific policy, a disaster drill, a sort of plan in place to protect not only patients, but the employees who are working in the emergency department to ensure that we have the safest working environment. And then there's other parts that relate to contracting and ensuring that emergency physicians, regardless of their employment status, they have the same rights and privileges as other medical staff. And part of that brought up the question, as we market this accreditation, it depends on who employs you. Is it the hospital? Is it the group? How do we ensure that? And so we took a piece of the standards out of the accreditation package and labeled it under a second sort of bundle that we call the blue ribbon recognition. And that part really focuses more specifically on rights for emergency physicians and currently could be marketed to either the hospital or the group to make sure that we're having the really the best contract and fair standards to provide best working environments. And that blue ribbon recognition would include things like due process for emergency physicians to ensure that they have the ability to defend themselves if they feel that they were unfairly terminated, the ability to have a decision by their peers to ensure that they were not unduly terminated or taken off the schedule, that we ensure contracts do not have restrictive covenants or non-competes so that physicians have the ability to practice within a certain geographic location, that medical staff and privileging forms include questions that are not biased, specifically ones that ask about previous psychiatric or substance abuse care, that if it doesn't relate to their ability to perform their job, i.e. they had an eating disorder in high school or they had some anxiety during college, that is completely irrelevant to their ability to deliver care today, that those questions are not required on the credentialing form because we don't want to disincentivize physicians from seeking mental health or discouraging people from being honest about their own healthcare need to take care of themselves. And finally, the ability to view itemized reports of what's billed under their names to ensure that there is some transparency and that physicians are being held accountable and having that open communication with their employer to ensure safe and fair billing. So those are things that, in addition to the resources for the emergency department and the facility, some other sort of professional employment contracting that we are hoping to raise the bar on as well.
And that blue ribbon program, is that something that, let's say, a large corporate medical group that has practices in multiple states, if they agree to do those practices across the board, could they receive that blue ribbon designation for all of their sites if they're agreeing that they're implementing that across the board, or will they have to apply for it for each individual site?
That's a great question, right? There are many groups who say have 20, 30 contracts. And so maybe they have those best practices at five of their sites, but not necessarily all of them. How do we handle that? So the blue ribbon can be achieved two ways. One is it's through hospital accreditation, in which case, if it's the hospital that is purchasing accreditation, we would include that blue ribbon recognition as part of that. There's no extra fee. And because the hospital is the one doing it, you are attesting to that one site that they have not only the facility standards, but also the physician standards. So that by definition would include each individual hospital through that accreditation process. If it is a group that is applying for the blue ribbon recognition, it would be for all of their sites. So they wouldn't be able to say do it for half, but not the other half. And again, that would require verification and contacting their employees to ensure that those processes are actually occurring and being executed in a way that we deem really fair to the emergency physician employee.
That's exciting because I feel like there's been so much divisiveness in our specialty. And what I've come around to is there may be certain practice setups that are less likely to run into these problems. But I don't think we can completely get rid of corporate medicine. But what we can do is incentivize and put regulations in place that curtail bad behavior. So, I mean, I see this program as the carrots.
I do too. And I think that's really the key differentiating factor. And a lot of people have misinformation about what is a corporation? How does the group work? What is even due process? How do we define it? It can get very complicated. But what we can do is promote best practices. And this is a way for groups who do comply, who do offer those services to be able to market and advertise, which we think will help with physician recruitment, potentially even nursing recruitment or other staffing to show that the work environment has these things in place to help set us up for success. And I think a big part of this is recognizing that happy emergency physicians provide good care, right? We need those that resources, that space to be able to eat and drink at our workstation, which, by the way, is another accreditation criteria. the things that don't directly relate to patient care, but relate to the doctor who's taking care of them. And if you can't eat or drink for 8 hours, if you don't have a room to pump, if you're breastfeeding, you're not going to be able to provide good care. You have to have these essential resources to be able to make it through an 8 or 10 or 12 hour shift. And so some of these, again, are aimed at the patients, at the public, but also at the physicians who are providing that care to really raise the bar on and making a better work environment for everyone.
Yeah. When I speak to emergency physicians, I actually was just on a call with somebody last week that was saying that she feels like her group has cut any potential fat. There's no redundancy at all. Like the staffing ratios are so bare bones that when you have those days where a lot of people check in, it's potentially unsafe. And that falls back on the emergency physician to try to figure out a way to get through those shifts. Will the accreditation process get that granular, looking at like the number of patient visits per shift? Is there enough data to support that the staffing models that are, quote, safe? I mean, it's taken me a long time working in emergency medicine to get a sense for like what is potentially a problematic staffing number. I know that's kind of a weird question, but is there any granularity on that?
Not yet. And the reason is because we couldn't get agreement on what constituted a fair supervision ratio. And I think because there's so much variability, right? I mean, you could have a lower acuity, like my naval hospital, it doesn't see trauma. We don't see that many heart attacks or strokes. And so my patient per hour is going to be a little different than somebody who has 3 or 4 critical care septic patients that they're putting lines and tubes in. It also varies depending on who you're working with, right? Do you have residents? Do you have emergency medicine residents versus another specialty who don't multitask the same way we do? That we didn't want to punish emergency departments, if that makes sense. We want this to be more of a carrot than a stick, and learning some of the failures of previous accreditation, recognizing that if we try to get too granular at the beginning, it likely wouldn't succeed. And we don't want to make it so hard for groups and hospitals to buy in that they never apply in the first place. So we thought rather than going with ratios off the bat of looking at staffing and supervision requirements, which to be honest is going to be, I think, a huge hurdle for many hospitals that don't have direct or indirect supervision. So that in itself is a pretty big change for a lot of places. But what we found from geriatric accreditation is that it's as much about hospitals wanting to get accredited, but what they really don't want is once they get accredited is to lose it. That the risk of having it taken away was actually more of a motivator than that initial ability to market it. So again, we'd like to kind of start at a obtainable level to meet people where they are, and then over time, increase those standards. And I think as time progresses and we have a better grasp of depending on your volume, your acuity levels, all those things, that we can potentially one day look at that. But it gets tricky. Like even the definition of a triage level, of a level 2, level 3, is variable and not very scientific or rigorous, and oftentimes is not accurate. So we want to make sure that we are not penalizing hospitals, but doing it in a way that promotes really productive, safe care. But that certainly is an area of interest and one that I think over time we need to grapple with.
Part of the incentive, I think, for places to get stroke designation or cardiac designation, well, I think there's a couple. There's a financial component that people with these conditions, and even once you're in an ambulance, they're going to direct that ambulance to that site if they're a stroke center or STEMI center. But the other part is the quality piece that behooves the hospital to become a stroke center, become a STEMI center, because the quality metrics are built into that tie into reimbursement. With the ED accreditation, are there any conversations that are happening right now about how accreditation gets into that quality space? It seems like if I'm accredited ED, the quality that I care that I provide will be improved, but are there more specific areas of alignment between the ED accreditation and quality?
Yes. The short story is we are looking at specific quality, but again, we are trying to at first capture metrics of like, what are they doing? So part of the accreditation standards currently are that you are monitoring and recording a time of presentation to discharge for treat and relief patients, as well as presentation from decision to admit and decision time from that decision to admit to when they go upstairs. Again, that may seem crazy to people, but there's a lot of hospitals that aren't even tracking that, and they don't know what their time metrics are. So we're putting in the beginning of having, you got to at least report a time. And then over time, maybe what should that ideal time be? And part of that is also built in is what is the expectation for consultants to come down to the ED to evaluate their patient, to put in orders? All of those things impact boarding. Another one of the standards is having a policy of for patients who are boarded in the ED of ensuring that it is the patient is under the care of the physician who is placing orders on the inpatient side and not the emergency physician. Because all of those things, we know boarding is inversely related to quality care, to mortality, you know, for so many different things. So indirectly, these standards affect our ability to decrease boarding, to monitor progress, to track those time metrics, as well as having a process of reviewing and completing charts of ensuring that somebody is reviewing percentages of people's charts to be able to give them feedback on their compliance with metrics and overall care, of making sure those standards are actually in place. We think that there may be places that are saying they do that, but they don't necessarily enforce it. And this will kind of hold people accountable to having a process to ensure that quality care is being delivered. And there's about 5 to 10 different specific standards that relate to quality. But again, keeping it relatively simple for this initial round, it won't have specific metrics related to quality or specific times, but more just the process that they are tracking them. And then we anticipate in the future being able to utilize our data registry called CEDAR to be able to tie those metrics to actually improvement in quality and patient care.
That's awesome. So when can we start seeing this accreditation happen? Do you have any idea on timeline?
So we are going to pilot with the first, I believe it's 5 or 6 emergency departments this spring. Our hope is to really start in April or May of this year for those pilots. Like anything else, when you launch it, I'm sure there's going to be feedback that will help us tweak or recognize that the application might be confusing or metrics that were too easy to meet or some that were too hard that we may have to make kind of minor changes based on the feedback from those initial sites. The Board of Governors will then meet and kind of review that feedback from our pilot sites and then hope to launch really later this summer or fall for anyone who's interested in accreditation. But the timeline is very much 2024. So this is the year to get it going, and we could not be more excited.
Wow. I have to say, this process of moving towards accreditation is my greatest hope for our specialty. It almost is surprising that there hasn't been something in place to like set the bar. And I've had this feeling that in some ways, our ability to be MacGyvers and to be champions for our patients has been used against us, that we've always been the glue in the system that's been falling apart. And this is finally starting to say that there has to be some boundaries around what is acceptable for an emergency department.
Absolutely. I think that's why I'm so passionate about this. And you asked at the beginning, why am I doing this? Why am I volunteering my time? I mean, I can't think of anything more important than our ability to define what those standards should be for patients, for us to prevent burnout, to ensure we're giving quality care. It is one of the most rewarding, exciting jobs, but it can also be one of the highest burnout and reasons for people to leave the specialty. And until now, we really haven't been able to enforce best practices. And there's been a number of issues of how do we track this? How do we, protect physicians and empower our members to be able to speak up, to advocate for what we think that healthcare delivery should look like? And this, to me, has always really been a way we can achieve that. Using policies that were written and rewritten and scrutinized by emergency physicians, not insurance companies, not hospital executives, but people who have boots on the ground, who are working the night shift and the weekends and the crazy hours to say, this is what I need. This is what our department should have to thrive and to take excellent care, that if I came in as a patient or my mother or my brother, of what I would want to ensure that they got the best care delivered by the best person available to make sure that we are delivering what we intend, which is the highest quality care 24/7, 365 to anyone who walks in that door. And I think this is the way we can actually get there.
Yeah, this is very exciting. I think this is a good opportunity to let people know about how they could get involved in ASAP. So maybe they're hearing this and they're excited that there is some good news coming, that there's a big light coming through this tunnel. Because a lot of people still feel a lot of burnout and frustration coming out of COVID, and that some things are actually, I mean, for me, I feel like boarding's the worst that it's ever been for the sites that I'm working. So how can people start to get involved and move the needle through ASAP?
The biggest thing is to become a member. Even if you don't have the time or the capacity to get involved in a leadership position or a committee, just being a member helps us really talk to Congress to be able to have the voice to say that we represent tens of thousands of physicians, and that advocacy money to make those changes, to meet with the White House, with these government bodies, to really push on laws that could, you know, potentially fix boarding and some of the consolidation and things that we're seeing within the specialty to be able to advocate for us. So being a member is number one. Number two is talk to your group, talk to your hospital about getting accredited, right? This is going to be one of those things about momentum. And the more we can get enrolled and accredited at the beginning, the more we can try and incentivize and advocate that all hospitals eventually get accredited, or as many as possible. So there's some information online I can send you in the show notes here, the website for ED accreditation of how your group can apply, and really getting the word out there. And the last thing I will say is that ASAP has also advocated for that transparency standard. So anyone who advertises or exhibits at a conference, there is the QR code that you can scan and you can look up their practices. And one of the things we're trying to do is to increase transparency. So when people do choose a new job or want to look to see what their employer offers or what they don't offer, is to figure out what practices, how they really take care of their docs, and to get more feedback before they decide to sign on a contract to see if this is a place where they're going to be happy.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to a day where this becomes so common that why would I work in a place that's not accredited? That's just part of the checklist when you're looking for jobs. I mean, it's essentially like, why would you step on a plane that's not certified by the FAA? It's about safety and it's about quality. And for me, it's about respect. I think that's the biggest thing when I talk to emergency physicians. I mean, if I had a dollar for everyone who sees the line that I feel like I'm a burger flipper, that I'm replaceable and that I don't have a voice, that's, I think, what breaks my heart the most. And I hope that this is a step in the direction of, no, just like a trauma surgeon, they have that accreditation, that there's limits, there's expectations. And just like the cardiologist, that they can count that everybody's working to meet their STEMI requirements in neurology, that we, the frontline people in the emergency department, also deserve the same respect, that there are certain resources and policies and procedures that need to be in place for us to care for patients.
I could not have said that better myself. Very well said. I 100% agree. And it's about time that we be recognized like any other specialty. What are those standards? What are those resources? How do we ensure that we are promoting and improving patient care and fair, productive work environments for all emergency physicians? And I really hope that that's the answer.
Yeah. And who knows better than us? And that's what I'm also really excited about. This isn't a different entity coming out and saying that this is what you all should do to have emergency departments work. It's coming from us, that we actually know how emergency departments work best. And this is us coming together to say this is what it takes to be an accredited emergency department. So any last words, Dr. Schmitz?
No, just thank you for helping to get the word out and for supporting this program, and for all the listeners out there. And please feel free to reach out if you have any questions or if we can send you some materials on how your hospital or group can get accredited. And thank you for this time to this important initiative.
Yeah. And on that note, if you're not an emergency physician and you're listening to this, you can still reach out. You can still ask us for that information, because I think this is good for all of us. Because as Wendy Dean has reminded me, author of If I Betray These Words, the truth is we could all be patients and we all will be patients. And I'm going through my family members getting sick, and The items that you mentioned, this accreditation, my dad did not have access to those in the emergency department in his community. This matters. So whether you're an emergency physician or a cardiologist or a pediatrician, we all can become patients and we all deserve quality emergency care.
Well said, my friend. Thank you for this.
Thanks for listening to The Revitalizing Doctor, a project of Revitalize Women Physician Circle. Our mission is to connect women physicians and allies through innovative, value-based coaching methods that align trust, support, accountability, and skill development to ignite the courage and clarity necessary to take bold actions, create change, and thrive. If you're interested in working with us, check out our website at peoplealwayshcc.com/revitalize or email us at revitalizemm.info@gmail.com. This podcast represents the views of our host and guest. It does not reflect the views of any institution we work for or with.